Carl Zimmer is our next guest. He is a popular science writer and blogger focused on evolution, medicine, biotechnology, and natural history. He is a frequent contributor to the New York Times, National Geographic, Scientific American, and Discover Magazine, where he is a contributing editor and writes the award-winning blog, The Loom. He appears regularly on National Public Radio and is a lecturer at Yale University. He has written 12 books, including Evolution, The Triumph of an Idea, and has twice won the Journalism Award from the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Please give a warm welcome for Carl Zimmer.
Good morning. I'd like to start today by introducing you to somebody who has very many interesting names. He was known as the Repulsor of Millions, the Lord of the Two Lands, the son of the god Re. I'm talking about Ramses V, the pharaoh of Egypt from 1149 to 1145 BC. We don't know a lot about his life. Apparently there was a civil war during his reign. He was buried 2 years after his successor took over, which suggests that he didn't meet a very good end. But we know some interesting things about how he died. And we know it because in 1979, a doctor named Donald Hopkins got permission to examine his mummy. So he had been dead for over 3,000 years, but Hopkins was still able to examine him and discover something very interesting. As you can see in this picture, there are pockmarks all over his face, and Hopkins saw yellow pustules on his shoulders and his chest over much of his body. And Hopkins knew what this was. This was smallpox. This makes Ramses V very important, actually, in the history of civilization. For one thing, he is the oldest person with evidence of a smallpox infection. So we know that over 3,000 years ago, people were dying of smallpox. And bear in mind that this was a pharaoh. This was perhaps the most powerful man in the world at the time. But all that power and all that wealth couldn't protect him from a microscopic particle. Today I want to talk about the future of viruses, but as we've seen in a number of the talks here, sometimes the best way to talk about the future is to look at the past. And the past of viruses actually tells us a lot about how they will continue to have a very important part in our life, but maybe one that you're not expecting. The virus that killed Ramses is smallpox. Viruses in general are pretty much the same. So, and Sir Peter Medawar, a great immunologist, summed it up very nicely when he said that a virus is a piece of bad news wrapped up in a protein. This is the flu. It just happens to be a nice diagram. It's got a few genes inside, and it's got a protein shell on the outside, which has special proteins for locking on to cells and invading them. So they have an incredibly beautiful, simple way of replicating. They invade cells, they unload their genes and some of their proteins, and then the cell itself is basically forced into making new viruses. In the case of smallpox, people pick it up often through the mouth. It disseminates throughout the body, and then eventually it produces scabs, which is how it is able to go and transmit to another person. It kills about 30% of its victims, and it has been staggeringly successful at killing people. There was one estimate that during the 1400s, the 1500s, the 1600s, in Europe alone, 5 million people died of smallpox every year. When Europeans came to the New World, they brought, among other viruses, smallpox, which killed millions, maybe tens of millions of Native Americans. We really don't know how many. Suffice to say that this is a virus that has killed billions. It was probably in China or India that someone got the idea of actually inoculating people with smallpox virus to trigger an immune response that would protect them. It was a tricky thing to do. Side effects included death. Edward Jenner, in the late 1700s, got the better idea of actually doing a vaccine using a much milder virus related to smallpox, cowpox, because he noticed that the milkmaids around his village never seemed to get smallpox. And that was because they were basically getting vaccinated by their cows. Now, the invention of technology, and this is technology, does not automatically solve a problem. Smallpox did not immediately disappear. And in fact, even in the 20th century, 300 million people died of smallpox. The reason that we beat smallpox is that we had vaccines, we improved the vaccines, and then there was a massive global campaign to get rid of it. This is just one poster from part of that campaign. It started in the 1960s, and by 1980, smallpox had been eradicated from the face of the earth. There are now only two stocks of smallpox that are known of. One is here in the United States, one is in Russia. And so in the wild, it has been driven extinct. We live in a post-smallpox world. This is the first time that we had been able to rid ourselves of a virus. And we just witnessed the second eradication of a virus, Rinderpest. Rinderpest infects cows and is completely devastating to herds of cattle. This is a picture from the late from the 1890s when a Rinderpest outbreak killed almost all of the cows in southern Africa. It was staggering in its lethalness. And then in 2011, after another long global campaign, Rinderpest has been completely eradicated. It's gone. Now, we've seen a lot of curves at this meeting, and I have some curves to show you as well. I mean, in the case of, say, computing, the curves might show the power that your computer has over the years. It becomes more and more powerful. The curves that I can show you are ones that go down. So smallpox goes from being incredibly common to zero. Rinderpest goes to zero. Here's polio, which had put FDR in a wheelchair. It's not at zero yet, but thanks to a vaccine and another public health campaign, it's getting very close. In fact, polio only really survives in certain areas that are war-torn or where there are opposition to using the vaccine, like certain areas of Pakistan. Perhaps one of the most important curves I can show you is this one. HIV has, since 1981, been one of the top killers in the world. And unfortunately, year after year, more and more people each year would get infected with it. And that actually started to crest in the 1990s, and it's slowly falling. And the deaths from HIV seem to have crested as well. And partly that's because we have the invention of antiviral drugs that can stop HIV from killing people. You can't get rid of the virus yet, but at least hold it in check and keep people's health up. So we might be looking at the start of another one of these downward curves. And there's a lot of optimism about new treatments that might actually lead to it being eradicated. In the future, actually, I think one of the biggest benefits we're going to get in terms of treating viruses are in terms of viruses that you might not even realize are viruses. There are viruses that cause cancer, and perhaps the most famous one is human papillomavirus, which can cause cervical cancer. Rebecca Skloot's best-selling book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, is about the origin of an experimental line of cells, the HeLa cells, which came from a woman who died of cervical cancer. What happened was that a virus invaded her cells and turned them cancerous. And they grow so fast that they still grow 50 years after her death. There are actually a lot of cancers like this caused by viruses. About 1.5 million people die every year of them, it's estimated. Perhaps more. This is 15% of all cancers. And as opposed to other cancers, which might have environmental causes, this is a cancer you can vaccinate. So we can vaccinate people to get rid of cervical cancer, and it will be gone. We can vaccinate against, probably against other cancers as well, and you can expect that in the future. Now, that might have filled you with optimism and hope. You could think of our world of viruses as a bucket with, and we've drilled holes in it, and the bucket is draining out, and soon it'll be empty, and everything will be great. Unfortunately, the bucket is under a faucet. We are having new viruses enter our lives, adapting to our species and making life difficult for us. Actually, HIV itself is a great example of this. This is a tree, an evolutionary tree, and that black dot there, those three black dots, show you several times in which HIV jumped from chimpanzees to humans, mutating, evolving, adapting to our biology. Not only do we know now that it came from chimpanzees, but we know when and we know where. The worst form of HIV crossed over from chimpanzees to humans in that little red circle there. Probably a hunter hunting for chimpanzees, some blood got into a cut, perhaps, and then the virus started adapting. Now, as you can see, there's a river that connects that circle to Kinshasa, which is was then known as Leopoldville in the early 1900s. And Kinshasa is where the first sort of major kind of urban center of HIV infections came. So you can see how basically HIV got a foothold, as it were, in our species thanks to what we were doing, thanks to 20th century colonialism, deforestation, building of railways and traffic systems, growing populations. All of this is really great for a virus. And this was not some isolated incident. Just 10 years ago, you perhaps will recall that there was a SARS outbreak. This is a virus that no one had seen before. It came out of nowhere. By the time it was done, 8,098 people were sick. 774 of them died. And so the scientists were saying, well, where did this come from? So they looked at the virus, they looked at its DNA, and they compared it to other viruses to see if they could find relatives. They looked in animals. They found it in palm civets, which are animals that are sold in marketplaces in China, where the outbreak occurred. So then the scientists made a complicated evolutionary tree, which I'll show you here, and basically this is just what you need to see, is that humans and palm civets, yes, they both got SARS, but they got it from something else. They got it from a bat. So bats now are proving to be a really wonderful source of new viruses, if you like that sort of thing. We beat SARS, but we didn't do it with a vaccine. We just used quarantine, which is something we've known about for over 600 years, since the Black Death. We were lucky, because SARS shows its symptoms quickly, and if you quarantine people, they can't transmit it, and it's never come back. But that being said, there still will be more viruses. So just last year, for example, farmers in Europe, actually around a small village in Germany, started noticing these kind of horrific birth defects they'd never seen before. Devastating stillborn deformities that damage the nervous system and so on. It started off in the summer and just took off. It spread into other countries. And as you can see here, that was the spread of this mysterious disease just in a matter of months. So scientists looked at these dead sheep, these dead cows, and they tried to figure out what was causing it. And again, they found a virus. This was a virus that had never been seen before. They called it the Schmallenberg virus, named after the village in Germany where they had first discovered it, the symptoms. So this is another evolutionary tree, which kind of gives scientists a clue about where it came from. Just a little clue, though. Because what's weird is that the closest relatives of the Schmallenberg virus are in Japan. So no one can really tell how Schmallenberg evolved from these Japanese viruses and how it ended up in Europe. But one thing they do know is that it gets spread, not by a cough, not through blood contact, but by insects. So it's kind of like West Nile disease. West Nile is spread by mosquitoes. Schmallenberg virus is spread by midges, which are mosquito-like insects. But in any case, these midges go from flock to flock. Some of them probably got swept across the English Channel to England, where they started infecting animals in southeast England there. Over the winter, midges died off. Lambing season was over, so you didn't see many cases of it. And so people thought, well, maybe we dodged this bullet. Not the case. This year came back, and it's spreading even more. So in England, for example, it spread all the way through England and went into Wales, and now it's at the border of Scotland, and the Scottish farmers are very nervous. This looks like it could well be kind of a fixture of, you know, life in Europe, a virus that did not really exist a year ago. I could give you plenty of other examples. I don't know if you read about a virus that spread by ticks that was discovered in Missouri, just reported a couple months ago. There's a new hemorrhagic virus found in Africa, causes lots of horrific bleeding. if you read about enough of these new viruses, you can freak out a little. Which is probably why there have been so many great movies about viruses that have been made. And we should be concerned. I mean, we have to be concerned because there, you know, we know that new viruses, a lot of new viruses have crossed over into our species over the past century, and we don't have a whole lot of great treatments for them. There is no treatment for SARS, for example, except for quarantine. We don't know what to do about it. That being said, I don't think that we should feel totally hopeless. In fact, we should have a lot of confidence. There are things we can do now that Edward Jenner say couldn't. For example, we can sequence their genes very quickly. So here's another curve, and this shows the number of viruses whose genes have been sequenced, and it's exploding. So a mysterious disease like Schmallenberg shows up, and you know it can get identified and sequenced in a matter of weeks or even days. And so this is a huge advantage we have. We have this incredible power. But again, you know, you have to bear in mind that it doesn't matter how fancy, you know, your car is. Like, who is steering it, and what are they doing? We don't know a lot, unfortunately, about some of the most worrisome viruses. We don't have particularly good monitoring systems in place. The flu, for example, spreads from birds to people, and fresh waves of flu virus cross over every now and then. There's one called H5N1 that scientists are very worried about now, but we have a very thin monitoring of where it is now. It just pops up in different countries, and we don't know why, we don't know how it's mutating. We just don't know what's going on. What we need is better monitoring, and we need more innovative research. So, for example, flu viruses, if you got your flu shot, and I hope you did, that was grown in an egg, a chicken egg, which is what people did in the Eisenhower administration. It's incredibly slow. It takes months to breed up these vaccines. What we need are better ways, faster ways of making vaccines. And so a company called Medicago, for example, is doing some really innovative work actually producing vaccines in genetically engineered tobacco plants, which grow quickly, and you can grow a whole bunch of tobacco plants. You don't have to be sitting around waiting for chickens to lay their eggs. So we need all of this. I just want to stress, because we have so many viruses out there, and I just real quickly, I'll give you a sense of the places that you can find viruses. You can find them a mile underground, in the water, in subterranean caves. You can find them at the South Pole, in the ice, where they're infecting bacteria that live there. You can find them inside of us. We have trillions of viruses inside of us when we're healthy. A lot of them infect the bacteria in our bodies. Some of them infect our own cells, and yet don't make us sick. This is how many viruses it turns out that there probably are on Earth, 10 to the 31. And it's kind of hard to give you a sense of how big that is. One way of thinking about it is saying, okay, let's take all the viruses on Earth and stack them one on top of the other. How far can we go? The answer is 200 million light years. So there are a lot of viruses out there, and we're not going to get rid of them all, and it would be foolish to think we could. Perhaps a better way of dealing with them is to find a kind of peaceful solution where we can shield ourselves from the worst of them and take advantage of all the incredible experimentation that they have evolved. I'll just give you a couple examples before I stop. There is a virus that infects insects, caterpillars, and it causes them to climb up to the top of trees where the caterpillars then explode and release the viruses down on the caterpillars below. It's wonderfully horrific. And it turns out to be a great way of making proteins because the viruses make protein balls to embed new viruses. So if you just genetically engineered them, put them in a cell culture, you can make any protein you want. This is a billion-dollar industry now. Gene therapy is made possible in many cases because viruses are so good at pasting DNA into other genomes. So all the great advances we've had recently with gene therapy have come largely with the help of viruses as our little genetic engineers. Angela Belcher at MIT is doing mind-blowing stuff using viruses' ability to bind to things. So she's actually using viruses to assemble solar cells and create more efficient ones than we've made before. So, you know, I can't tell you that, you know, in 2 years from now we're going to be facing, you know, a outbreak from some South American bat that's going to kill 83.7% of the human population. I can't tell you when HIV will be eradicated from the face of the earth. The one thing I can say is that viruses are going to be surprising us in the future. And what I hope is that at least some of those surprises will be pleasant ones. Thank you very much.
Time for a handful of questions. Let's start right down here on the aisle. Do we have a mic in this row? Yeah, great. Coming right to you.
Thanks. You talked a little bit about how the development of human infrastructure and intercontinental travel and deforestation serves as like an accelerant for the spread of viruses. But wouldn't you also say that now our global interconnections of communications serve as a way to much better monitor, I mean, the viruses? Like rapid genomic sequencing with handheld devices, isn't that something that would have as big a positive effect as intercontinental travel?
That's a good point, and it could if we actually lived in a world where there were virologists with handheld devices doing that right now. That's not the reality right now. There's the potential to take advantage of that, but it's not happening yet, which is a shame because the system is all there in place and we could use it. But I would say that you're starting to see some of the glimmers of that. I think one of the most interesting examples of that was in 2009 when we had this new strain of the flu pop out of nowhere. And, you know, scientists, again, were like saying, well, what is this thing? What kind of flu is this? Where did it come from? They figured it out very quickly, just in the matter of a couple weeks. And it was an international collaboration that was basically being done by a bunch of different research centers who were pooling their findings on a wiki, which was completely open. So, you know, anybody could sort of watch their progress as it was happening. And they nailed it. I mean, they figured out how it had evolved from pigs, a pig virus, and so on. And so I hope that there's more of that in the future. But just because the potential is there doesn't necessarily mean that people take advantage of it.
There's a question down here in the third row.
How much sleep do you lose when thinking about this century, the ability of humans and scientists to create a virus that is detrimental to our species and can wipe out a billion people?
Yeah. So the question of actual, you know, synthetic biological warfare is an important one. I think I get more sleep about it now than I used to. Just and part of the, what sort of had led me to that was reporting for the New York Times and elsewhere about some experiments on the flu where scientists were taking this kind of bird flu I mentioned, H5N1, and they were tinkering with it, adding in mutations to try to figure out, well, what is it that makes it able to cross over and become a mammal to mammal flu? And it was a huge concern about this, like, oh, you know, if you publicize these details, then anybody could just take this and run with it and synthesize this virus and then, you know, just have a grand old time with it. But I have to say that I think a lot of the loudest voices are the least rational about this, in the sense that people were saying, like, just some garage biologist could do this. And, you know, I talk to scientists about what it actually takes to make flu viruses, and that's not true. It's at least, in the state of synthetic biology right now, you can't do this sort of thing in your garage. Now, maybe 20 years from now, you will be able to, and that, you know, obviously, like, you know, every, you know, all these curves are moving. So that is a possibility, but then we have to sort of wonder about the rationality of the people doing it. You know, if you are a terrorist and you decide to turn bird flu into like the next pandemic, you're probably the first one who's going to die. Not only that, but if you like go and try to release it in a country that you despise, we know from past flu epidemics that within a few weeks it'll be back in your country. It spreads so fast. So, you know, there might be just completely nihilistic maniacs who might want to do this, but. But then I feel like we're in a James Bond movie at that point. So I guess these are like, I think of them as incredibly small probability, incredibly high risk prospects we're looking at. So they're very hard to judge, but we know for a fact that viruses do very well at crossing over on their own. And that's definitely gonna happen in the future. So that's what keeps me up at night more.
About a question right here.
Just a quick clarification. Was the 10 to 31 viruses, was that individual viruses or different virus genomes?
That's the estimate of how many individual virus particles there are. As to how many species of viruses there are, it's hard to say. First of all, it's hard to even say what it means to be a virus species, but what is clear is that most of the world's genetic diversity is in viruses. So if you were to like make a catalog of every different gene on Earth, the majority of them would be from viruses. So viruses, I didn't really have a chance to talk about this, but viruses are hugely important as a force in the evolution of life over the past few billion years. Like they move genes around to different hosts, and so they're like a repository of life's genetic information.
So there was a hand up toward the back.
So you just sort of answered my question a little bit, but I was going to. I've heard that there are about 10 to the 30th bacteria on the planet, and that about a third of them are taken out by viruses every day. And I was wondering if you could speak to the amount of protein novelty that viruses may or may not be creating on the planet relative to, like, a lot of people think that evolution at the protein level might be happening in eukaryotes or whatever, and not realizing.
So viruses themselves are evolving very quickly to adapt to their hosts, and then every now and then, some of their genes end up in their hosts, and that includes us. So about 8% of the human genome derives from viruses that infected us, and like HIV, can insert their genes into our genes. A lot of that is just baggage. It's just doesn't do anything. But some of them have been co-opted and have actually, they serve a function for us. So for example, the human placenta, it needs a virus protein in order to stick properly to the uterus. So with, and you know, our ancestors got infected with this virus protein maybe 50 million years ago. So none of us would be here if not for that infection, not for that virus. And in terms of your other question, yes, bacteria are by far the most abundant host for viruses because there are just so many of them all over the place. And there are lots of viruses that, that infect them. And, you know, it's generally pretty bad to get infected with a virus if you're a microbe because you just explode when it's done. You know, you just burst open with new viruses. And so in the ocean, bacteria just burst open, as you say, like a third. I've even heard some people say a half maybe of bacteria get killed every day in the ocean. And there's a huge amount of bacteria in the ocean. And so all that carbon's getting dumped out, and it probably has a huge effect on the climate because, you know, it's possible the carbon's going back up into the atmosphere where it can trap heat, or it's possible it gets rained down to the bottom of the ocean. Nobody knows yet, but there's probably a virus-climate connection. It's a, they're a planetary force.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. Carl Zimmer, great talk.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for being here.